Hello, my name is Michael Grabowitz. I'm the chairman of the Institute for Literacy and Learning. And before we begin, I have some very important messages. If you have not done so already, please print the handouts being used today on this call from the Institute's website at www.theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. If you have a question for Dr. O'Connor, please email it to straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Again, the email address is for any question during the conference or even following the conference, straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org, no spaces. All emailed questions and their answers will be mailed to everyone registered for this call. Each of you who registered for this conference call will receive an email survey. Please help us serve you better by filling out the two-minute survey when it's sent to you following this live chat session. The Institute truly appreciates your input, and we use your ideas to plan future Straight Talk live chat conference calls. And again, thank you for joining us today for our monthly Straight Talk live chat. Today we have the honor of being joined by Dr. Rolando O'Connor. This very special person has spent a lifetime of research in the field of reading and the professional development of teachers. Dr. O'Connor's research is grounded in the growing consensus on the role of phonological awareness, the ability to manipulate the sounds in spoken words, in the acquisition of reading. Although compelling evidence prior to the 1990s suggested that very poor readers might profit from instruction in phonological manipulation skills, the knowledge base did not include information about how children in special education would fare with such instruction. Dr. O'Connor's early studies focused on whether and how improving phonological skills might lessen the severity of reading disability. Since that time, she has continued to work in reading intervention and tackled issues of early identification of reading disability, professional development of teachers in research and evidence-based practices, effects of multiple layers of support to children over the first few years of schooling, instructional issues for older students with reading difficulties, and transfer and generalization of phonemic manipulation skills to reading words. Today, Dr. O'Connor will be discussing teaching older poor readers to read words. This conference call, like all others, is being recorded and will be available in the library section of our website for you and your colleagues' future listening pleasure, along with all the other past conference calls that we have recorded. In the next few days, please check your email inbox for the next Straight Talk Live Chat conference call with Dr. Deb Glazier, a co-author with Dr. Louisa Moats, November 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Dr. Glazier will be speaking on planning professional development for positive reading success and growth. And I thank you again for joining us today, and now I present to you Dr. Rolando O'Connor presenting Teaching Older Poor Readers to Read Words. Good afternoon, Dr. O'Connor.
Good afternoon, Mike. Thanks very much for inviting me. I received from Amber Davis at the Institute a list of those of you who are participating in the conference call today, and I'm very pleased to see that we have virtually all areas of the country represented, not just the continental United States, but also Hawaii and Alaska, so welcome to you all. Now, Mike mentioned that much of my research, has been with very young children, but today I wanted to talk about an enduring problem for reading teachers, and that's the older students who still have great difficulty reading words after several years of schooling. It can be useful, I think, when we think about older readers to have a sense of how reading develops for most students. We think about oral language developing very early in life, and as an example, I'm a new grandma, and my three-month-old grandson is much too young to begin to speak or to pick out the phonemes or the speech sounds in the words that he hears. But already at 3 months, he has the notion that conversation involves cadence, and so he's experimenting with the sounds that he can produce that have rising and falling pitches. And even though he's not even approaching words, you can hear that he's trying to communicate. That's what words are for up until the time that we enter school, and it's not that words stop being meaningful at that point. It's just that when we think about teaching children to read, for a very brief period of time, we need to ask them to think about words not just as meaningful reference to things in their world, but as collections of sounds. That's the notion of phonemic awareness. From there, and understanding that words can be broken into sounds, children begin to learn the letters of the alphabet and how to associate those letters with the sounds that they commonly make. They learn to decode words that they've never seen before, look at a collection of letters and regenerate the speech sounds that are represented by those letters. They learn to recognize words that can't be decoded, words like laugh, common words like they. Even think about the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. None of those are decodable words for young children. But recognizing words isn't enough. Children need to recognize them at a rate at which they can rely on the spoken language they've developed from infancy in order to understand what they read. Comprehending language never goes away as an issue for children, and it becomes an even more important issue for these older students who aren't reading, because much of vocabulary develops through the act of reading, especially the kinds of language that don't relate to the here and now. Things like once upon a time are not things we say to each other. It's not conversational speech, but it sets a tone. It sets a type of language that students come across in books. Now, for comprehending written text, oral language isn't enough. They need to understand figures of speech. They need to be able to parse what they read into phrases and meaningful aspects that they can link thought units one across another so they can comprehend what they read. Certainly good spelling would be nice too, but that's way beyond our topic today. What I want to point out from this developmental progression of early literacy to skilled reading is this time frame of oral language begins very early, way before we ever meet these students. Phonemic awareness typically develops in kindergarten, as do letter and sound correspondence understandings. The great role of first grade teachers is teaching children to decode words and also to recognize words that are of high frequency. We expect children to be developing reading fluency from roughly the middle of first grade when they have enough facility getting words off the page that they can begin to read them more rapidly. Comprehending written text becomes the primary focus of reading instruction from about fourth grade on. But here's where we draw the line. To comprehend written text, the job of learning to read in the first place, takes getting those words off the page. And the kind of instruction the teachers do with students to teach them to get those words off the page typically happens from kindergarten through third grade. So when we meet these older poor readers, students in fourth grade, fifth grade, middle school, and high school, who haven't yet learned these early skills, we really are stuck with an enduring problem. And that's what I want to address today. If we think about how to approach effective instruction for these older poor readers, we need to think about where that particular student falls on the reading continuum, on that developmental level. Can they hear that one-syllable words are composed of individual speech sounds? Can they match those speech sounds to a letter or a collection of letters from the alphabet? Can they string those letter sounds together to decode words? Do they have a good core of sight words already? Oftentimes, our older poor readers have better developed sight word ability than a younger student reading at their same level of reading ability. When we know where a student falls on that reading continuum, we can begin to make intervention matches, to find an intervention that's likely to address their primary area of need, and find one that has a strong research base, one that is truly likely to work, because these students are already so far behind that it makes sense first to begin with instruction that works for most students, and then if we find that it's ineffective for a particular student, start to make some adjustments. The last point in thinking about how to begin effective intervention with these older students is while they may be way behind on the pre-skills that should have developed much earlier, we need to shore up those pre-skills and simultaneously maintain age-appropriate oral language. By maintaining oral language ability that is age and grade appropriate in these poor readers, we keep them strong participators. Ways to do this, for example, might be to alter homework assignments that we do with these older poor readers so that where a fifth or a sixth or a seventh grader might take home a history book and read a chapter and answer the questions at the end, we might send our older, poor readers home with a taped version of the same chapter so that they can listen to it a couple of times, learn the new vocabulary that's involved in that chapter, come back into class ready to discuss on an age and grade appropriate level the content. Now, that's the job primarily of the content-level teacher, but at the same time, we need to think, what do these students understand about reading words? And find interventions that we can use that can build their ability to recognize words in print while we're still trying to keep them as strong as possible on content. So if we get back to thinking about teaching these older students to read words, there are many approaches that we might use. Word study strategies cross the gamut of phonic analysis, teaching the most common sound for each letter, structural analysis, where we're teaching letter combinations, how to break these long words apart, rule-based instruction, like the silent E rule, or when to drop an E when you're adding an ending that starts with a vowel letter, when to double a consonant at the end of a short word before you add an ending that's common, like ing or ed or ly or ness or less. We also need to think about multi-syllable word strategies. Now, this is important for these older poor readers because while phonic analysis can be the most efficient way to help students unlock a word that they've never seen before in print, if they've failed for years and years and years in phonic instruction, by focusing on multi-syllable word strategies, we can help them to take advantage of the relatively well-developed sight word learning that they've already mastered to use those sight words with bigger chunks, teach them a few rules on how to combine and break apart these multi-syllable words. And for some older students, that is more effective if phonics instruction has not been effective in the past. We also need to think about morphemic analysis. Now, you hear all over the place about phonemic analysis. The phonemes being the speech sounds in spoken words. But the morphemes are the meaningful parts of words. And I'm going to show you as we progress through this talk this morning how we can get double duty out of using the meaningful parts of words with these older poor readers. Lastly, there's contextual analysis. After a student attempts to decode a word, does it make sense in context? Is that a sensible word to use to fill the hole in this sentence? And the reason that I put contextual analysis way at the end is that that's what good readers do. They see a word they don't know, they do their best to get that word off the page, and then they try it out. Is that a sensible pronunciation for the word? In general, what these students are trying to do is make a match between the word that they generated by trying to decode it and their entire word store in their long-term memory. Is this a word I've heard before? We put contextual analysis at the end rather than at the beginning of word study strategies because older poor readers might be over-relying on context. As an example, if you teach students in fourth grade and beyond, you've probably encountered students who see a difficult word, stop, take a look at that first sound, and then make a guess and just hope that the word that they've generated that starts with that same first sound might be appropriate. Students perseverate in this first sound and guess strategy because it's been effective for them in the past. Students in first grade, for example, can look at a first sound, make a guess at a word using the picture context of the text that they're reading. And oftentimes the pictures will be great cues for making a lucky guess. Once a lucky guess turns out to be correct, that habit begins to become cemented, and children continue to use that first sound and guess strategy when it is no longer effective. One of the important points that William Nagy has made in his research is that children can guess with context in first grade very effectively, in second grade with 50 to 60% accuracy. By third and fourth grade, when there are no longer pictures coming along with the text, their percentage of accuracy using that strategy drops off dramatically. And in fact, by fourth grade and beyond, the hard word that the student doesn't know tends to carry the meaning of the sentence. So at that point, the first sound and guess strategy is useless. That's why we put contextual analysis at the end, because it makes an excellent checking strategy but a very poor strategy for getting the word off the page in the first place. So in thinking about where these older students are likely to fall down, we need to come back to where in the reading continuum the pitfalls tend to be. If you're working with a very young child in kindergarten, the most likely suspect of the reading breakdown is understanding and using the alphabetic principle, understanding that any word that they say can be broken into sounds, and then any sound that they say can be represented by a letter or a collection of the letters from the alphabet. That's simply how reading and writing works. By first grade, we expect our students to enter the schoolhouse door already understanding the alphabetic principle. And the job of the first grade teacher is teaching phonics and teaching blending strategies for decoding words. But many of our students with reading problems not only are struggling with phonics, but also haven't yet mastered the alphabetic principle. By second grade, the main job of the teacher is to help students recognize words more rapidly. In other words, begin to work on consolidating the instruction they've had over the last couple of words, over the last couple of years, so that the job is to read with more automaticity, to read with a better rate, better phrasing. But while the second grade teacher is working with most students on reading fluency, there's still quite a number of students who haven't mastered decoding, who haven't mastered the basic principles of phonics, and are still struggling with the alphabetic principle. And you can see by third grade, the multisyllable words, morphemes, comprehension, those become the instructional targets, but many students haven't mastered the skills that should have been learned in kindergarten, first, and second grade. Same thing with fourth grade. You can see how this snowballs into the older the child is, the more the student has to catch up, the wider the gap. So how do we go about catching up a fourth grader, fifth grader, middle schooler who still doesn't understand the simplest things about reading, things like the alphabetic principle? Well, one of the activities that we've used successfully with our fourth, fifth, and sixth graders in our studies is an activity that we call segment to spell. Now, although this activity can be used effectively with first graders at the beginning of the year, it makes an excellent catch-up strategy for older students. Now, you might think that this activity is so simple that we just shouldn't even address it, that it might be demeaning to an older student. But if we think about the research that's been presented to us, Jewell's study, for example, in 1988 found that the fourth graders who were poor readers had the level of phonemic awareness that you would expect of a beginning first grader. And in our study in 2002, when we were working with fourth, fifth, and sixth grade students who could not hear that middle sound in a one-syllable word, an activity like segment to spell used just for 4 to 5 minutes a day over a two-week period caught them right up to being able to hear those pesky interior sounds in spoken words. And that's the place where most of our students, most of our older students with poor reading tend to fall. They can hear the first sound. In many cases, they can hear the last sound. But they have trouble with the middle sound in spoken words. Another study that used this technique, also called word building in some other studies, was a study by McCandless that was published in Scientific Studies of Reading just a few years ago. And in their study, they were working with second through seventh grade students and found that using this kind of an activity, again, just for a few weeks, turned students' writing that had been uninterpretable into writing that could be read by others because at least it was phonetically spelled. The activity looks like this. You take a form like this, an Elkhonon box, with three squares to start with. You can move into four squares later on in the second week. And you present students with a word. Here's a word, fat. Say that word, the child repeats, fat. Let's say it slowly and touch the boxes as we say the sounds. Fat. What's the first sound? Do you know a letter that makes that sound? The child chooses the letter F and puts it in the first box. Now let's say all the sounds in fat again. Fat. Do it again. I'm going to stop you. Fat. Stop right there. What was that middle sound? Do you know a letter that makes that sound? Good. Push it into the middle box. Let's read what we have so far. Fat. and without the child could complete it with a t at the end. Now let's read back what you just wrote. Fat. Did you spell it correctly? Sure you did. Now here's another word. Fit. Say that word slowly. Fit. Look at what you just spelled. Say fit slowly again and see where you need to make the change. The child then pulls out the A, substitute it with an I. Read back what you've written now. Fit. Did you spell fit correctly? Now what we're doing here, although it seems like a very simple task, is teaching children the alphabetic principle. And that's what those fourth graders in Jewel's study and those third, fourth, fifth, and sixth graders in our study tended to lack. They thought that the spelling of words was capricious. By doing an activity like segment to spell, you show students very quickly that even just changing one letter in a spelled word changes the identity of the word and the way it functions in a sentence. It's very quick to teach, and it's an important first step in catching up these poor readers, because once students can spell a one-syllable word with some logical progression of letters or collections of letters from the alphabet, it is now a reasonable transition to go into two-syllable words as we move more toward multi-syllable word analysis. Now, the second stumbling block that you'll often see for these poor readers is blending those speech sounds together. It's important as a reading teacher to understand which words can be stretched out, in other words, saying each letter sound, holding the others in short-term memory. A word like fast, for example. If that first sound is a word that is a sound that can be stretched, you can teach children to blend that word without stopping between the sounds. Touch under each letter, and as you move on to the next letter, don't stop between the sounds. Fast. By teaching children not to stop between the sounds, it's much less likely that they'll read the word reversed, as they might if you had them go fast. We often see that reversal, and it's because we let them stop between the sounds, so the last thing they hear is that last sound, so that's the one they want to start with. Now, not all words can be stretched. Take a word out of the Batman comics, like bam. You can't stretch out that sound for the letter B. So for this kind of a word, you can use a strategy called bigram blending. Now, the researchers who began studying this strategy were Fain and Bryant back more than 20 years ago now. We did a replication of this strategy with some reading recovery rejects in first grade, and were able to replicate Fain and Bryant's results. The way it works is you start with a short word that cannot be stretched because you can't stretch out that sound for the letter B, and have them say the vowel sound first. So touch under the A, say that sound. Ah. Good. Put the first two sounds together. Ba, and then add the last sound. So put those first sounds together. Bam. Now you've taken a word that can't be stretched because the first sound cannot be held, and you've given them a strategy where they can say the whole progression of letter sounds without stopping between the sounds. Now, sometimes we want to work with word families with these older poor readers, and I'd like to give you a word of caution there. Typical readers do just fine with a word family approach, but what poor readers will tend to do on the day that that long list of words, all of which have the same rhyming pattern, is introduced, is to use the rhyming sound to read the word. In other words, you show children, all of these words have the it sound. Take a look at that first word. Starts with s, ends with it. Put it together. Sight. Read the next word. Fight. Read the next word. Ite. Now, what happens is that the good readers will be sort of excited about that. They'll see that I-G-H-T, and they'll see that the I-G-H-T is the same in each of those words, and it's likely that after you go through four, five, six different words that have that pattern, that they'll retain that pattern. They've actually learned it. They've learned to read it. They've learned to spell it. Where we go wrong with the poor readers is it's possible for them to read that whole list of words by looking at the first sound and guessing. And those children are not likely to have attended to the I-G-H-T pattern. Rather, they've looked at the first sound, generated a rhyme with immediately after instruction to read that list, the child reads it correctly by looking at the first sound and guessing. But if you show the child one of those words the next day as they walk in, here's the word F-R-I-G-H-T, what word is this? The child might go and not come up with anything. Fought? That starts with, ends with T. Because the child hasn't really learned the pattern. So for children with word reading difficulties, we try to avoid these patterns in the first parts of instruction. Now, we sometimes wonder just how regular a language English might be, because sometimes we say, well, we shouldn't teach children with phonics because English is just so irregular. But if we think about this common lament, we find that there are patterns of regularity in English, and they span the alphabetic level, they span the syllabic level, they span the morphemic levels. As an example, somewhere if you're keeping notes, write the word definite. Now, a child hears the word definite, and it's likely for that middle syllable, they may be tempted to write something like F-A, definite. They might not hear that that's an I, because we often slur it together, and it sounds like it could be spelled with an A sound. If we teach children that words are formed by meaningful collections of printed chunks, the morphemes, then we can teach them that the reason that definite is spelled with an I in the middle is because of those morphemes that make up the word, morphemes like define, morphemes like finite. So there is a regularity to spelling that is related to the morphemic content of the word. Treeman also did a study now about 10 years ago where she noticed in asking children to spell various kinds of words that the regularity, for example, of the k sound in English is much stronger than teachers initially thought. We think about the k sound and we think, well, gosh, we could spell it with a C or we could spell it with a K, or sometimes we spell it with a CK, for example, at the end of a word like duck. But a child trying to spell duck might spell it with a C at the end, might spell it with a K at the end, might spell it with a CK at the end. But if you ask the child to spell the word can, you almost never see a child spelling the word can, C-K-A-N, because they learn that there's a regularity about that C-K combination. It virtually never comes at the beginning of the word. Because children do, over time, pick up through exposure to printed English that even though words can be spelled in multiple ways, some ways are simply not allowable, it makes sense to use what is most frequent in teaching these older students patterns that they can then use to both read and spell words. Now keep in mind that these older poor readers will have a larger core of sight words than younger children reading at the same reading level. If we go back then to the sight words that these older students probably already know, the 100 most frequent words, for example, we can pick out some of those patterns in the 100 most common words, and you'll see that on that slide of patterns in the 100 most common words, and teach children to read those patterns using words that they already know. For example, OU in isolation may seem difficult to an older, poor reader, but if you start with a word like out, they know the word out. They know the word around. So if you have them then underline the OU in the word out and make those sounds, ow, t, which letters make the ow sound? And they can generate the OU. So OU says ow. And in fact, it says ow in most of the words in printed English. If you go to the next page, there's a list of those highly regular letter combinations. This particular list comes from work by Carnine, Kamanui, and Silbert. But the functionality of a list like that is if we want to know which letter combinations we should be working on with these older, poor readers, this makes a really excellent list. Take a look at those letter combinations. These letter combinations make the sound you think they will make more than 80% of the time in the 10,000 most common words in print. The one exception in this list is that double O combination. And it's about 50-50 whether it's going to make the uh that you hear in book or the oo that you hear in cool. So for that particular combination, you can teach children to try out both pronunciations as they work toward decoding words. I am giving you an example of the silent E rule just because we did some analysis of the basal series that are used commonly on the in the western half of the state here some years ago, and found that rather than teach silent E as a single generalization, many of the texts for teachers were introducing the silent E 8 to 12 times in first grade readers, each time with a different rhyming combination, like let's spend all day now on the AKE sound. 3 weeks later, let's spend another week on the OKE sound, without pointing out to children that it's really just one generalization. So this is just a routine for teaching silent E that generalizes. When we teach children a generalization like this, whether it's a silent E, whether it's when to drop the E at the end of the word before you add a new morpheme, whatever these rules might be, it takes longer to teach children a rule than it takes to teach them a word family. But you only have to teach it once. With word families, each new word family is a generalization in and of itself. Now, as quickly as possible, we want to get these older poor readers off just single-syllable words and into moves toward two-, three-, and four-syllable words. Most older readers will have picked up the inflected endings because those are taught very early and they're very high frequency. By inflected endings, we mean the tense changes like ed, ing, and the plurals like an S or an ES ending. The next logical step is words that divide between consonants. And I'm deliberately not saying words that divide between double consonants. Double consonants like BB, NN, KK. When we teach children to locate in a word that appears to have more than one syllable or more than one beat, two consonants in a row, and you can take a look at the next slide for just a list of beginning words that might have that two consonants in the middle pattern. It really follows the same rule as a double consonant. For example, words like cannot, rabbit, and happen have the double consonant rule that many of us were taught as youngsters. But the rule has much stronger generalization. When there are two consonants, any two consonants, doesn't have to be the same one, that falls in the middle of the word, that's generally where that word divides. So once children can take a word like goblet and find the B and the L in the middle and divide between it, gob is decodable. So is let. Same thing with cactus. Cac is decodable. Tus is decodable. Cactus. Many of the words that have two consonants in the middle function that way, so it's a nice way to start. The next way to work with these poor readers is to think about the common affixes or the morphemes in words. When I was working on the word lists to include in a book that I put out last year, I came across some great studies of analyses of the 10,000 most common words in print. One of those studies was by White. You'll see it cited in the most common affixes stage. What White found is that of all of the prefixes in words, 58% of those prefixes are made up of un, re, in, and dis. If you're going to start by teaching these older, poor readers the affixes, why not start with the ones that are most highly frequent? Because by teaching them these most highly frequent affixes, they will come across these more often in print and have a natural practice opportunity. That redundancy that they see one word appearing again and again and again, one prefix occurring again and again and again as they work with pages of print. The next slide has a number of affixes that can be taught in sets because they all have similar meanings. The wonderful double duty that you get out of morphemes is you've taught children to recognize a unit of print that is bigger than a single one sound, one symbol, a morpheme like un, or dis, or out, or super. Understand what it means. Add it to another short word, and have not only a decoding tool, because they recognize that affix, but also a meaning-generated tool. For example, if we teach children that un means not, and then they come across a word like unaware, then it helps children understand not only can I break apart this word into un and aware, but unaware means not aware. So it's very worthwhile teaching the morphemes to these older students. Now, Some researchers have taught morphemes to children as young as first and second grade, but developmentally, most children have more interest in morphemes when they're taught in third, fourth, fifth grade, and beyond. The next slide around enter gives an example of how you might teach the meaning of a new morpheme. What inter means between. So what does inter mean? So what would interstate mean? What would you call a highway between states? So what would interperson mean? What then are interpersonal skills? You take, in other words, a definition for a short word, and then you build it into increasingly long words that are more age and grade appropriate for these older readers. Now, when you're teaching the meanings of words or the meanings of morphemes, you can take a more constructivist or conversational approach. Beck, McCowan, and Kukin recommend this approach in bringing words to life, where once you've taught the meaning of a morpheme, like enter, you can also have them generate other places where they have come across that morpheme. Think about older students in a science class. If they understand that inter means between, they can unlock a word like interatomic. They see inter, they see atom, they see ick. Interatomic, between atoms. Intercellular in biology for a ninth grader. They recognize inter means between. They recognize the word cell. Intercellular, it means between cells. You can stretch it into mathematics. Intercorrelation. So once you teach children with a morphemic approach when they're older, you can get them to rapidly build into these multisyllable words that make them feel more confident in their reading and help them be more effective in the content areas. That next slide shows a strategy for attacking words that have multisyllables. The first strategy that you see there is breaking the word apart. If you've taught children affixes or morphemes, and children bring then their natural ability to have a better developed sight vocabulary than these younger students, and it gives them the tools to break apart a long word. I'd like to digress here for just a minute and give credit to Lenz and Hughes, because it's their dissect strategy that generated the best strategy that we've been using in our research. Dissect is very similar. The D-I-S-S-E-C-T, each stands for something for children to try. We found that when we were working with readers who were deeply struggling with word identification, that the eight steps in dissect were a little bit too much for them to handle. So we cut to the chase, and that's taking some of their tools out of dissect and putting it into a shorter acronym. The next slide shows how you might take some words that children might otherwise just skip over because they're long, and teach them to break it apart. Here's a long word. What do you see there that you know? Well, children will underline things like un, and then they'll realize, oh, well, there's also under, and they know that little word stand, and they know the ending ing, and they know the additional ending li. So once they've broken apart and they've examined some of the bigger words within that, then they put it back together again, they try the whole thing, and they have understandingly. She smiled understandingly. Now, when you teach children a strategy like best, a strategy like using the morphemes within words, you need to stick with that strategy for several days. You will know that children have actually learned that strategy when you see a couple of kids working together, finding a word that they don't know, raising their hand to get help from the teacher, and then one of the kids saying to the other, oh, put your hand down, I bet we can best this word. Then you know you've taught it well. Other strategies for decoding long words. Glass analysis has been around for a long time. It was a strategy introduced in the 70s. And yet it takes advantage of what these older students already know about words. For example, these older students know the little word may. They might not be able to read a word like delaying. But if you can show them how the AY functions in a word like may, then they can use that AY pattern in the middle of a word like layer, in the middle of a word like delaying. Use the best strategy to take a word like delaying, break it apart, recognize that they already know the AY ending, and it develops internal tools that students can use. You can see a more complicated strategy. This is also the best strategy that you see. A combination of glass analysis and the best strategy in the example of EVRY. Gaskins used this approach also in the Benchmark School program, where she introduced reading by analogy. And she found in work that she conducted along with Maureen Lovett that if you combine the decoding kinds of activities that we were doing in the first 10 minutes of this talk today with the more advanced strategies like reading by analogy, like BEST, like GLASS analysis, that you give students multiple and flexible tools that they can use for reading these long words. Now, we want children also to read words quickly. It's one part of the comprehension puzzle. We're not exactly sure what minimum requirements we should be working toward with students because there just hasn't been enough research that tells us how good is good enough. But we do know that silent reading is not very effective in improving children's rate of reading. That was shown multiple times in the National Reading Panel report. Now, I want to make sure you realize I'm not saying don't teach children to read silently. That's one of the major goals in reading instruction generally. It's just that if you want to build on children's rate, if you want them to develop a rate of reading that is functional for them, we're going to need to work on it aloud because children who are poor readers make too many mistakes to necessarily be able to comprehend what they read if it's at a level where they're making too many errors. Now, there are lots of methods that we could use for improving reading fluency, and I put some citations here that you might want to consider if you are working on fluency in your schools and districts. The people who have probably done the most research on building fluency would be the folks who have been working in partner strategies like class-wide peer tutoring, and that would be Greenwood, Del Quadri, and their colleagues. And the PAL strategy, Peer Assisted Learning Strategy, developed by Fuchs and their colleagues over multiple studies. Either of those are great ways to go with kids. What I'd like to show you, though, on the reading rates is some notions about what's average, and you'll see that in the middle column. First graders, for example, in March, on average, read 40, 45 words per minute. By the end of first grade, average readers are reading about 60 words per minute. But if you find students at the end of first grade who are reading fewer than 40 words per minute, they may be at risk for reading problems later, and you can see how that builds across the grades. Now, we're working with students who are poor readers, fourth graders, fifth graders, middle schoolers, high school readers. And if you time their reading fluency, we often find rates of 40, 50, 60 words per minute with these older poor readers. That's clearly dangerous. Now, although we know that good readers top out typically in fifth or sixth grade, reading somewhere between 150 and 160 words per minute, it's likely that we don't need to push our fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade poor readers to be quite that fast. As an example, Mark Landino did a study some years back where they found that for very poor readers, comprehension tends to break down at rates of less than 90 words per minute. And although this hasn't been verified in multiple studies, that might be a rate that's closer to what we need to generate. In one of our studies working with 4th, 5th, and 5th and 6th graders, we found that below 70 words per minute, there was comprehension breakdown. So over time, you can look forward to studies that are going to show us how fast we need to get in terms of pushing reading rate on our poor readers. But we do know that we want students to read with as little attention to decoding as possible as they read along so that they can put most of their energy toward comprehending those words, comprehending the phrases, comprehending the paragraphs that they come across and being able to relate it to things that they've read in the past. I'm going to skip over vocabulary at the moment because we did similar work when I was showing you how to teach a morpheme. There are some strategies here that you can think about. What I want you to notice is those two examples, Prodigy and Expedition, show a routine for teaching the meanings of words directly. And the important thing to attend to here is you can teach the meanings of advanced words even if children lack the skills to decode them. In other words, middle school students who are poor readers can be taught content area words in social studies and science as oral language activities where you give students a working definition or synonym. You have children use that exemplified here. Our teaching routines take about a minute to a minute and a half, whereas it takes a child who's a poor reader 4 minutes or even more to look up a word in the dictionary. By infusing oral language activities like the meaningfulness of words, like the meanings of the morphemes in words, along with our decoding practice, we keep children strong in their oral language while also shoring up those pre-skills where they fell down in the first place. So in our work, when we think about the keys to successful intervention, it's useful to think about where does this poor reader fall on the reading continuum? What can you choose then as an intervention that is likely to shore up that area that tends to be the downfall that you notice on the lowest level while continuing to work with age-appropriate oral language skills to keep students strong in the content areas? Keep in mind that while basal reading instruction sometimes suggests that teachers move from one strategy to another quite quickly, that when you're working with low-skilled students, you should probably keep with the strategy you're teaching for a week or 2 weeks or even more. It takes students a significant amount of time to learn a new strategy and particularly to learn to use it independently. What we're looking for as reading teachers is that independent use of new strategies so that we know we've given something of value to that student that they can use when they're reading independently. As students make progress on one level of the reading continuum, we'll know it's time to introduce the next logical step. Well, thank you very much for your attention today, and I'm looking forward to taking questions.
Thank you, Dr. O'Connor. Well, let me take everyone off mute so that maybe someone can shout out a question because I didn't get anything in the email yet.
Put them all asleep.
I hope I didn't. Hold on 1 second here.
The conference is no longer in lecture mode.
Now I hear a lot of laughter back there. I hope you all are having fun. Is there a question from the audience somebody would like to shout out to Dr. O'Connor while we have her on the phone?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I thought that you talked about the NRP report and about silent reading.
Yes.
I thought that, maybe I'm wrong, I thought that what they said is that there was no evidence to show that silent reading helped
closely,
not that there was evidence to show that it did not help.
You are quite right. There is no evidence to suggest that we should be having children read silently to gain fluency. But silent reading is good for lots of other things. There is, in the contrast, many studies that show that working with children reading aloud can improve fluency. In fact, they recommended in that report that would be a great study, is to have us reading silently as the contrast practice condition to other methods of building fluency.
Another question for Dr. O'Connor.
I have a question. I'm wondering if you have a suggestion for what to use for progress monitoring students who are getting older poor readers who are getting reading intervention, because currently our district uses only the oral reading fluency test from DBLS. Even when a student's problem lies in comprehension or some other area.
Yes. I have a couple of suggestions there. One is, yes, you can monitor their oral reading fluency. And when you measure oral reading fluency, there are strong correlations with other aspects of reading. But we're working on fluency building studies right now in our research team here, and we're finding that even when we do improve reading rate, we don't necessarily improve children's ability to decode words, and we don't necessarily improve their vocabulary.
Right.
So it's
and
useful to supplement a progress monitoring measure like oral reading with a measure that is perhaps less formal than that system, but that monitors specifically what you're trying to teach. So, for example, if you're working with an older poor reader who doesn't know those sound combinations or is not very effectively picking off the morphemes and using them to recombine into words, you might want to use lists of common sound patterns, lists of morphemes as supplemental to measure the growth that they're making in those areas. And also, we currently don't have a good ongoing progress monitoring measure of vocabulary, which is a huge area of downfall for many of our poor readers. The thing that frightens me the most, I think, about measurement systems that tackle just one thing is I worry that teachers will focus their teaching on just that one thing.
Right.
When what these poor readers need probably crosses virtually all dimensions of reading.
Thank you.
That was a great question. Is there another question in the audience?
Yes, Dr. O'Connor?
Yes.
Yes, I was wondering what you thought about the program Read Naturally to use with those struggling students for fluency, comprehension, vocabulary. What do you think of that program?
Well, there's currently a report out on Read Naturally on the What Works Clearinghouse.
Yes.
Database. They're not finding negative results. They're not finding positive results either. One of the things to consider when you're working with poor readers is what kind of feedback are they getting on their reading practice. Sometimes we have the luxury in special education of having children read aloud to an adult where they get help with all those hard words.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that that has a nice effect, not just on their reading rate, but also on their ability to recognize words from one piece of text to another. There's a huge redundancy. What I mean is that words repeat from one page to another.
Mm-hmm.
We use, for example, in our research, books that have high interest for poor readers but are written at lower levels.
Right.
For example, a sixth grade boy loves the octopus scene or the squid scene in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and we can find that book written on about a 2.5 level. And when a child reads one page and then goes on to the next page, roughly 50% of the words on the first page repeat again on the second page. So when we work with age-appropriate content but reading-level-appropriate text, students get a great deal of practice right targeted toward the level where they should be working. A potential problem with the packaged programs to have children read independently is they're not getting that help. See, if a child reads one page of text, maybe makes six errors and gets help on all those six errors, when they go on to the next page, the likelihood is they're not going to miss as many of those six words again.
Right.
And then they repeat yet on the third page, and their accuracy continues to go up, but only if they have help. Now, if they don't have help with those hard words, they make the same mistakes over and over and over again. So it's just something to consider if you're able to plan the reading programs for these youngsters.
Okay. Thank you.
You have packaged interventions, any of them that you would offer as being good alternatives?
I really hesitate to recommend any package program. because programs come and go. The important thing is to make all of us who teach poor readers smart about what it takes to teach a poor reader and what they need to learn. And if we have a good grasp on what they need to learn, then we can seek out programs that come and go and find those programs that are directed toward what they need to learn at that particular stage.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a recommendation as far as your first point, determine where the student falls on the reading continuum for older students? Do you have a recommendation for that point?
I would start by informal assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the sound. I would go right through when you see that early literacy to skilled reading, page number 2, slide number 2.
Yes.
you can figure out in about 30 seconds what a child understands about phonemic awareness.
Yes. So
just by giving them a few short words and ask them to tell you the sounds they hear.
Okay.
You can show them the letters of the alphabet, find out which ones they know and which ones they don't.
Okay.
Chances are older readers know the consonants.
Yeah.
They're having some trouble with the short vowels.
Okay.
Then move into those letter combinations that you saw on that slide, the most high-frequent ones.
Yes, that's good.
See which ones they know, which ones they don't.
Okay.
Just work through those slides that have lists and see what do they know.
Okay, that's good.
And then you
sense.
Can start your instruction targeted toward that.
Okay.
That's why, in some sense, a package program is not your best bet for an older, poor reader, because there'll be holes and things that they do know. And if you can cut to the chase and focus the time that you have for instruction most effectively, you can make more progress doing that than you can with most package programs.
Good, thank you.
Dr. O'Connell.
Yes.
We are having a little bit of technical difficulty here, and we missed your answer to the question about progress monitoring and things that you could suggest that we could use with the DIBLES fluency practice.
Alongside of the DIBLES fluency practice that you're collecting, I was recommending doing more informal assessment directed specifically toward what you're trying to teach. I am fearful that teachers sometimes will devote too much time toward teaching toward what's likely to show up on a measure versus what a student might need to learn. And there are so many features of reading that are important for these older students. Fluency is only one of them.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. O'Connor.
Yes.
I'd like to politely interrupt and say we're out of time, although these questions are absolutely dynamic. I would suggest to anyone on the call that if there is any other questions, I want you to email them to us at straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org, and we will contact Dr. O'Connor and find the right answers for your questions and get them all emailed to everyone that was on the call. If you could, just for a second, everyone, could you join me in a little clapping for Dr. O'Connor's presentation?
Yes, thank you.
Cross-country clapping, that was great. Thank you all.
Right.
Bye,
I want
thank
to thank you.
You
again, Rolanda, for such an inspiring discussion today.
Thank you.
I think we all are struggling across the country about what to do with the older, poor readers. And I think we've heard some questions that were surrounding a little confusion of exactly what to do. And I think we've all heard a variety of things or read a variety of things to do. I think you narrowed it down very quickly. I know that some of the programs that are being sold on the market, I too agree with you, Dr. O'Connor, it comes down to good teaching practice.
That's right.
And I might add that Dr. Louisa Motz's work and Dr. Deb Glazier's co-author work in Letters as a professional development series might be something I might suggest at this particular point.
Can you repeat that?
Sure. It's Letters, LETRS.com. And actually, Dr. Deb Glazier, the speaker in November, is a co-author with Dr. Louisa Motz. Although she's talking about planning professional development for positive reading success and growth, I have a good feeling and a sneaky suspicion she might be bringing the conversation of Letters into the discussion.
Well, in that case, I will also mention that most of what I was talking to you about today can be found in my book, Teaching Word Recognition, which is in your references.
Ah, there you go. Well, I think we've covered all the plugs we need to do today on the Leno show. I want to add that Marilyn Adams, Dr. Marilyn Adams, has done a lot of speech recognition work about what you were talking about, Rolanda, when
yes.
you said about the silent reading and the corrective feedback immediately.
Yes.
And that's where Marilyn's work has been the last 20 years,
mm-hmm.
is in technology, in speech recognition, where she actually invented something called the reading assistant. And I might tell you to look in that direction for some interesting technology.
Sure.
Other than that, I want to wrap up the call for today and say thank you very much. We have approximately 1,500 people in a variety of places across the country on this call. And thank you again from the Institute for allowing us to spew some good information to you again. And I add again that this call is being recorded. and it will be on our website tomorrow. So if there is any of your colleagues who missed it, please direct them to the Institute for Literacy and Learning's website in the library section. And I wait to hear from you all in November. So please have a great week and a happy Thanksgiving when it gets here.
Oh, great.
Talk to you all later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.